Good morning, historians around the internet. Welcome back to the Old History Podcast, where the goal is to just talk about history. So, unfortunately, I've got some bad news. Well, it's not really bad, but I got news from Facebook. At the end of May, the podcast will no longer be automatically shared to the Facebook page. However, I will still post it there. Sometimes I might forget, but I'll do my best to post it. Make sure it's posted there every Saturday so that you guys can still read it. So, in terms of the project I've been working on, things are moving along pretty nicely with it. I did find some graves out there. I don't know if I mentioned that last time. And I have a suspicion that there's a chance it could be a slave cemetery. I can't prove that. But I have taken lots of documentation of it, the graves and all that. So, but I don't want to talk about it too much. Don't want to spoil the surprise. So, like I said, I'm sorry I can't talk about it. I want to, but I can't. I was also contacted by somebody from, I think she said she was a board member of the McMinn County Historical Society or something like that. And they invited me to come down there. Well, that's a long way from where I live, but thank you for the invitation. I'll certainly do my best to get down there one day, but I've got my hands full up here for a little while. All right, so today's podcast is going to be over. It's not going to be over any battles, but it's going to be over two generals, and let's take a quick break, and we'll get right back into it. So, the first person I think who we'll cover first, and he's an important figure here in Tennessee, or at least in my area, you know, between Greenville and Knoxville. He's very important, and he's talked about a lot. And in Morristown, he has his own museum. It's called the General Longstreet Museum, and if you've never been, I suggest you go. The people there are very, very knowledgeable, and they're some great friends of mine. So the other person we're going to be talking about is, outside of General Longstreet, is going to be General Grant. And the only reason I'm putting these two together is because of the sole reason that both of these two men were great friends. In fact, they graduated from West Point together. And they were great friends throughout the rest of their life. Even during wartime and even after the war, whenever Grant became president, Longstreet supported Grant. All right, so the first person we'll talk about is General Longstreet. Of course, he was a Confederate lieutenant general, and he was born January the 8th, 1821. And his nicknames, he was often called Old Pete and the Old War Horse, often given to him by General Longstreet. Both of those were given to him by General Robert Lee. And Longstreet was considered to be one of Lee's most trusted advisors. Above everybody else, Lee went straight to Longstreet. So that should tell you something. And just to foreshadow a little bit of the podcast going forward here, after the war was over, Longstreet was the target of a lot of lost cause attacks. The South basically they disowned him because he was a staunch Republican supporter of that time, and basically he alienated a bunch of Southerners in his memoirs and letters that he sent to the New Orleans Times. So he was born in South Carolina, just to talk a little bit about his early life. But he spent a lot of time in his childhood in Augusta, Georgia, with his uncle Augustus Baldwin Longstreet. It's thought that he was very influential in Longstreet's early life as a supporter of states' rights. In his later years, Longstreet would go on to attend West Point Academy, where he graduated 54th out of 62 cadets in the class of 1842. While he's at the academy, this is what I mentioned earlier, Longstreet befriended a man from Ohio. His name was Ulysses S. Grant. And after graduation, both officers would be assigned to the 4th U.S. Infantry. Like many future Civil War generals, Longstreet's first real war experience came during the Mexican War from 1846 to 1848, where Longstreet rendered distinguished service in some of that war's most important battles, including Veracruz, Churubusco, and I'm not going to try to pronounce that. Chapultepec, or I don't know. Sorry, I'm. Anyway, he was wounded there. But anyway, he was wounded in one of those battles. He would go on to serve along his longtime friend and future subordinate, George, General Pickett, there as also. Following the close of the conflict, he continued his army career, where he participated in the Indian Wars, rising to the rank of major by 1858. After the outbreak of the Civil War, Longstreet, who was then serving in the New Mexico Territory, resigned his commission after nearly 20 years of service. And then he was almost immediately appointed Brigadier General under General Pierre Beauregard. You'll hear him mentioned as PGT Beauregard. And he reported for duty July the 1st in July of 1861. And his first action was at Blackburn's Ford, and he received praise for his coolness under fire and then the manner of which he inspired his men. Longstreet and then a feller named Thomas Jackson, probably know him as Stonewall Jackson, were both promoted to Major General under Joseph Johnston in October 1861. Following his promotion, Longstreet commanded a division of six brigades, the nucleus of what would basically go on to become the Army of Northern Virginia. In January of 1862, he was dealt a pretty hard blow when three of his children died in pretty close succession from scarlet fever. In spite of this terrible news, Longstreet performed admirably during the Peninsula campaign, often serving as the rear guards for Johnston's retreating army. I cannot talk this morning. At the Battle of Williamsburg in May 1862, General Johnston reported that he was a mere spectator for General Longstreet's clear head and brave heart. However, during the May 31st to June 1st Battle of Seven Pines, Longstreet bungles his orders and mismanages the battle itself. General Johnston was seriously wounded, and command eventually devolved on Robert E. Lee, then serving as senior military advisor to President Jefferson Davis, Confederate President Jefferson Davis. Longstreet quickly won General Lee's trust with his performance at the battles of Glendale and that following day, Malvern Hill. In a campaign that foiled the Union attempt to seize Richmond, Lee wrote that Longstreet was the staff in my right hand. That August at Second Manassas, Longstreet's wing of 28,000 men counterattacked the Union forces in what the National Park Service calls the largest simultaneous mass assault of the war. The Union left flank was crushed, and the army driven back to Bull Run. Longstreet was also noticed for his excellent performance the following month at Antietam, and his extraordinary coolness under fire continued to be a trademark. When Jackson's corps was assimilated into the Army of Northern Virginia, Longstreet was promoted to lieutenant general, and his corps would officially be designated as the First Corps. During the very bloody Battle of Fredericksburg that December, Longstreet took advantage of the terrain to create an almost impenetrable defense along Marye's Heights, From the heights above, he used his artillery so effectively that no Union soldier could come closer than 30 yards to the infamous Stone Wall. From February to April 1863, Longstreet led two of his divisions to southeast Virginia for the collecting of food and forage, and was therefore not present for the Battle of Chancellorsville that May. Longstreet did, however, rejoin Lee's army for the second invasion of the North and the subsequent Battle of Gettysburg. He was an outspoken proponent of Western concentration, and Longstreet was very skeptical about the wisdom of that invasion. A further dispute between Longstreet and his commanding general over the nature of the campaign would only grow during the battle and its aftermath. While the corps commander was under the impression the army was to wage a defensive battle whenever possible, Lee, who, emboldened by his recent victory at Chancellorsville, insisted on attacking the numerically superior Army of the Potomac. Longstreet's corps arrived on the field July the 2nd, 1863, one day after the fighting had begun. After the Virginian denied him permission to flank the Federal Army, two divisions of the 1st Corps launched an attack on the Union left wing late in the afternoon of July the 2nd. Now, despite the initial success in breaking these Federal lines, Longstreet's men were denied victory, and the casualties were high. And nevertheless, Lee was determined to exploit what he believed to be a weakness in the Union center, and planned an assault for the following day. Longstreet's troops would spearhead the Forlorn Hope. They voiced his strenuous objections to the plan, but was rebuffed. On July 3rd, and perhaps the war's most famous episode, troops from Longstreet's corps under Major General George Pickett charged across the open fields to assault the Union center, only to be repulsed, again at a great loss. For the remainder of his life, Longstreet would continually assert his opposition to Lee's command decisions at Gettysburg, much to the disdain of his fellow officers. This opposition, combined with the allegations that he deliberately delayed the execution of Lee's orders, did much to tarnish his reputation. That autumn, Longstreet was sent west to the aid of Braxton Bragg, and his troops arrived on September 20th, just in time to rout a significant portion of the Union line at Chickamauga. Only the staunch resistance of George H. Thomas saved the Union army. The stubborn General Bragg, however, was less than warm in his reception of General Longstreet and his staff, especially when several of Longstreet's generals wished to have Bragg removed from command, but President Davis would not have it, and Longstreet's reputation was damaged just that much more. After a very difficult winter and an abortive attempt at independent command in East Tennessee, Longstreet and his men were happy to return to the Army of Northern Virginia in 1864. So I'll just stop here for a minute. This is where Longstreet spent his famous winter in Tennessee, at the William Patrick Ninney home, where he set up his winter headquarters in a little town called Russellville. And he brought with him 28,000 troops that were scattered across the landscape. A famous spot for this is they basically were concentrated all around the hills around the Ninney home, Hay Slope. Bethesda Church was supposed to be an improvised field hospital, and they were there as well. So that's the famous winter he spent in Upper East Tennessee. At the Battle of the Wilderness in May 1864, Longstreet and his men performed well, finding a hidden route from which they could attack Union forces, catching them in deadly crossfire. On May 6, in an incident very similar to Stonewall Jackson's mortal wounding the year before, Longstreet was fired on by his own men. A mini bullet passed right through his neck and shoulder, permanently paralyzing the general's right arm. He survived, but he did not return to his corps until October, by which time the Confederate army was deadlocked in defending the besieged city of Petersburg. And Longstreet would be assigned to protect Richmond, Virginia, and the vital railroads that supplied the city. On April 2nd, 1865, the Union forces would break through the Confederate line at Petersburg when A.P. Hill was killed. Longstreet took command of his Third Corps. By April the 9th, Lee would surrender the Army of Northern Virginia to U.S. Grant at Appomattox. Longstreet and Lee were parted ways by April 12th, and Longstreet would move to New Orleans, and the two men never saw each other again. In 1867, the New Orleans Times asked several leading citizens to comment on the newly passed Reconstruction Acts. Lord have mercy. Unwisely, Longstreet suggested that the Southerners support the Republicans. He was praised in the North, but was pretty highly vilified in the South. In June 1868, he would receive a presidential pardon by an act of Congress with help from General Grant, his good friend. He would then go on to support Grant for president, and when elected, Grant nominated Longstreet to be the Surveyor of Customs for the Port of New Orleans. For this last betrayal of the South, he was labeled as a scalawag. Many of his actions after the war were controversial. His letters to the New Orleans Times, his support of the Republican Party, his acceptance of political appointments, and the fact that he commanded African Americans on behalf of the New Orleans Metropolitan Police Force. Worst of all, he dared to criticize Robert E. Lee's leadership and very quickly became the head target, the center of the bullseye for the Lost Cause attacks by Jubal Early, William Pendleton, Reverend William Jones, and quite a few others. He spent the rest of his life attempting to restore his reputation. In 1889, he was dealt another huge blow. His home, Park Hill, burned to the ground in April, and his wife, Louise, died in December. Despite the many attacks by former officers in the Confederate Army, many men fondly remembered their days fighting under Longstreet. In 1890, the Washington Artillery, famous for their performance at Fredericksburg, insisted that Longstreet participate in the unveiling of the Lee statue in Richmond. In 1892, at the third annual United Confederate Veterans meeting, at the former soldiers flocked to him. He spoke at the dedication of the Chickamauga and Chattanooga National Park in 1895 and attended the 1902 centennial celebration at West Point. He would publish his 800-page memoirs called From Manassas to Appomattox in December 1895, and in September 1897, he married a 34-year-old woman named Helen Dorch, and his family wouldn't really be pleased with that marriage, although Helen would defend Longstreet's name until she died in 1962. Longstreet died January 2nd, 1904, a few days short of his 83rd birthday, and he was buried at Alta Vista Cemetery in Gainesville, Georgia. And we'll take us a quick break here, and then we'll talk about Ulysses Grant. Born Hiram Ulysses Grant in Point Pleasant, Ohio, the future General-in-Chief's name was changed due to a clerical error during his first days at the United States Military Academy at West Point. To his friends, he was known simply as Sam, and after a mediocre stint as a cadet, he graduated 21st out of the 39 cadets in the class of 1843. Despite his less than exemplary school record, he performed well as a captain during the Mexican War of 1846 to 1848, winning two citations for gallantry and one for meritorious conduct, only when the fighting stopped and Grant was assigned monotonous duties at remote posts far from his wife and family did he again begin neglecting his work and began drinking heavily. He resigned in 1854 to avoid being drummed out of the service. He spent the next 6 years in St. Louis, Missouri with his wife, Julia Dent Grant. After several short-lived pursuits, including a brief episode as a farmer, he moved to Galena, Illinois to be a clerk in his family's store. And when the Civil War began in 1861, he jumped at the chance to volunteer for military service in the Union Army. His first command was as the colonel of the 21st Illinois Infantry, but he was very quickly promoted to brigadier general in July of 1861, and in September was given command of the District of Southeast Missouri. His 1862 triumphs at Fort Henry and Fort Donelson in West Tennessee won him the nickname of Unconditional Surrender Grant and placed him right in the middle of the public eye. However, when a surprise attack by Confederate forces at the Battle of Shiloh yielded pretty devastating casualties during the first day's fighting, President Lincoln received several demands for Grant's removal from command. Nevertheless, Lincoln refused, stating, "I can't spare this man. He fights." The following day, Grant's army, bolstered by troops under Major General Don Carlos Buell, fended off the Confederate advances and ultimately won the day. Grant's hard-won victory at Vicksburg, Mississippi, in the May of 1863 was a strategic masterpiece. His army would cross the Mississippi River at the Battle of Port Gibson, and with Confederate forces unclear on his intentions, he sent a portion of his army under General William T. Sherman to capture the state capital of Jackson, while setting his sights on Vicksburg with a view towards permanently closing off the Confederate supply base. With initial assaults on the city demonstrated the strength of Vicksburg's defenses, the Union Army was forced to lay siege to the city. On July the 4th, 1863, after 46 days of digging trenches and lobbing hand grenades, Confederate General John Pemberton's 30,000-man army surrendered. Coupled with the northern victory at Gettysburg, the capture of Vicksburg marked a turning point in the war. It also made Grant the premier commander in the Federal Army. Later that same year, he was called on to break the stalemate at Chattanooga, further cementing his reputation as a capable and effective leader. In March 1864, President Lincoln elevated Grant to the rank of Lieutenant General and named him General-in-Chief of the Armies of the United States, making his headquarters with the Army of the Potomac. Grant was determined to crush Robert Lee and his vaunted Army of Northern Virginia at any cost. He was plagued by reticent subordinates and petty squabbles between generals and horrific casualties, though the Federal host bludgeoned Lee from the Rapidan River to the James in what one participant will later describe as an unspoken, unspeakable history. The battles of the Wilderness in Spotsylvania, Cold Harbor, and then the Siege of Petersburg effectively destroyed the rebel army, leading to the fall of Richmond and Lee's surrender at the Appomattox Courthouse. Grant's forces had been depleted by no more than half during the last year of the war, it was Lee who surrendered in 1865. After the Civil War, President Andrew Johnson named Grant the Secretary of War over the newly reunited nation. In 1868, running against Johnson, Ulysses Grant was elected as the 18th President of the United States. But fortunately, though, apparently innocent of graft himself, Grant's administration was riddled with corruption and scandal. For 2 years following his second term in office, Grant made a triumphal tour of the world. In 1884, he lost his entire savings to a corrupt bank. To make up some of the losses, he wrote about his war experiences for Century Magazine. They proved so popular that he was inspired to write his excellent autobiography, Personal Memoirs of U.S. Grant, finishing the two-volume set only a few days before dying of cancer at the age of 63. He's buried in New York City in the largest mausoleum of its kind in the United States, which is supposed to be reminiscent of Napoleon's tomb in Paris. His Grant's tomb is regarded as a national memorial. So that's two of the most important generals in the Civil War. Hope you guys enjoyed the podcast. Nonetheless, if you made it this far, thanks for listening. You can always subscribe to the podcast if you want to support your favorite internet historian. Well, have a good weekend, y'all. See y'all next time.